Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. On this 50th anniversary of the riots surrounding the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, we'll begin with Marilyn Katz, a writer, consultant, and longtime political activist. She was head of security for the anti-war group Students for a Democratic Society at the time, and we will look back at this key moment in our history as the forces of the establishment clashed with an insurgent anti-establishment counterculture protesting a senseless and endless war in Vietnam. We'll discuss the role of television carrying the riots into the living rooms of America, with the CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite commenting on the air on August the 25th of 1968 as the convention began that, quote, "The Democratic Convention is about to begin in a police state. There just doesn't seem to be any other way to say it." Amid the mayhem outside and the chaos inside the convention, the unpopular Democratic candidate, the then Vice President Hubert Humphrey, won the nomination and was subsequently narrowly beaten in the general election by the law and order candidate Richard Nixon. This has led many historians to conclude that the televised riots, later referred to as a police riots, cost the Democrats the White House and prolonged the Vietnam War under Nixon. With the resistance movement growing in opposition to the unpopular Trump administration today, we will explore lessons learned 50 years later on how to bring about regime change in America. Then, with the resignation today of the ombudsman overseeing the $1.5 trillion student loan market in protest to the White House's open hostility towards protecting the nation's millions of student loan borrowers, we will speak with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was a special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and joins us to discuss how the Trump administration is aggressively dismantling the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to free up predatory lenders to indenture America's students with a lifetime of debt and worthless diplomas. Then finally, we'll examine the report issued by the United Nations, which finds six senior military officials in Burma, Myanmar, guilty of genocide against the Rohingya Muslim minority, 700,000 of whom have fled for their lives to Bangladesh. A specialist on Burma, Myanmar, David Steinberg, distinguished professor emeritus of Asian studies at Georgetown University, joins us to discuss the irony that a government ostensibly led by the recipient of the Nobel Prize for Peace has been referred to the International Criminal Court for, quote, "indiscriminate killing, gang-raping women, assaulting children, and burning entire villages." And joining us now is Marilyn Katz, a writer, consultant, and longtime political activist. She is president of MK Communications, a partner in Democracy Partners, and a founder and co-chair of the newly formed Chicago Women Take Action. She was the head of security for the anti-war group Students for a Democratic Society during the time of the riots at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago 50 years ago. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marilyn Katz.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you again, Ian.
Well, it's good to talk to you, Marilyn. And, of course, a dear friend and colleague of mine, Haskell Wexler, made the classic film Medium Cool, since he was filming there at the time. And it's still an iconic film.
I think, actually, the moment and the year was transformative in lots of people's lives, including Haskell and a whole group of filmmakers in Chicago that he influenced. And by the way, just for the record, I was deputy in charge of security. Lee Weiner was the head of the big security, and he was the one who got indicted. I did not, thank goodness.
Well, but then isn't there a certain irony, head of security, considering what happened?
It is. So this was actually the second demonstration in which I had a leading role in security that year. The first one was April 27th, in which was the had occurred a few weeks after Martin Luther King had been killed, a few weeks after the west and south sides of Chicago had gone up in flames, and was the first time in the history of Chicago's 20th century anti-war demonstrations that were always small, in which the police actually gave us a preview of the summer and beat hundreds of people into the subway system in Chicago and arrested 400. So I was in charge of that one, too. You know, I don't know why anyone really would have used me again. But we were naive. We didn't really know what was coming.
Well, I think that's what, of course, is sort of reminiscent in terms of what's happening today, given the spontaneous demonstration that took place the day after Donald Trump was inaugurated, largely women across the country and around the world protesting spontaneously. That was an indication of a kind of, I wouldn't call it a counterculture. They certainly weren't hippies. But on the other hand, I still sense that, you know, one of the great tragedies, it seems to me, about resistance politics in this country is that the anti-war movement that you were a part of that was so visible in 1968 in Chicago, as soon as the war ended, it sort of disappeared. It didn't become a sustained political movement. And I wonder about the day after the inauguration. That looked like the beginning of a sustained political movement, but we talk a lot about the resistance. But I'm not sure what the face of the resistance is and how deep it is. So tell me
those are interesting, really interesting observations. I mean, one thing that is true, counter to the mythology, there's some myths that come out of 68. One of which is that after 68, after the demonstrations in Chicago, the movement went away. Wrong. Actually, after 68, the anti-war movement grew exponentially and continued to grow. And I think you'll remember 72, 73 in Los Angeles. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people are active. But you're right. The minute the draft was over, and given the change in the economy between 65 and 75, and without social media, the movement petered out. And while there were maybe 100,000 of us left around the country who were, you know, dyed-in-the-wool activists, I would say that in terms of mass activity, it's died out. But let me give you the Chicago story, which I think is different. And those of us, so in 1968, one of the things that the demonstrations did was consolidate the relationships between white anti-war activists and the young black activists who formed the Black Panther Party and the young Latino activists who formed the Young Lords and the Chicano movement in Chicago. And when I left LA and came back to Chicago in 1983 and worked to do the media and press for Harold Washington, its winning campaign, it was those same folks, my friends who I'd grown up with at 18, now 33, who were the core of the Harold Washington campaign. And let me take you further. In 2002, when Chicago became the first city to hold an anti-war demonstration against Bush's war, at which Barack Obama made his now somewhat famous anti-war speech, it was those folks from 65 to 68 who were at the core of that demonstration. So while it petered out, it also has a contribution to the arc of history. And I think that while Chicago is probably the strongest example of that, it's probably true in other places as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Marilyn Katz, a writer, consultant, and longtime political activist. She is president of MK Communications, a partner in Democracy Partners, and founder and co-chair of Chicago Women Take Action. She was deputy head of security for the anti-war group Students for a Democratic Society during the time of the riots at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. But in the sense that you had the establishment colliding with the anti-establishment and the young versus the old, the warriors versus the peaceniks, the law and order people versus the demonstrators. Again, trying to sort of get some analogies with the present, because I feel that there is a resistance, and there's certainly a lot to resist with the current criminal-in-chief in the White House. But even though he's a dreadful criminal and a disgusting man, and is doing terrible damage to this country and to the world and to America's position in the world. He hasn't actually been responsible for anybody dying on battlefields, which was the case back in 68, and certainly George W. Bush, probably a million people are on his conscience from the Iraq War and the consequences of that. And Obama's, during his period, I think thousands and thousands died abroad. So it's a little different, obviously, from that point of view, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think it's different, although, frankly, I think probably some people did die last year when Trump decided that he had to show that his hands weren't really that small and he exploded a bomb in Syria or somewhere, wherever he bombed last year. I think you're right. I think that what's interesting here is that the animosity and the abhorrence of Trump comes from what we didn't recognize in 68 is fundamentally a domestic attack on women and on minorities. And it is incredibly galling and surprising to people. So that the wars have been cleaned up. They're fought by proxy. They're fought, you know, the only bodies that you see dying or you don't even see them are people on the other side of the world in a video game kind of atmosphere. But I think what has caused the resistance is his unexpected attack on women and on blacks and on Latinos, which actually, to speak about ironies and analogies, actually was really what caused Humphrey's defeat. So, I mean, I think you've read, I don't know if you've read what I've written, mm-hmm. Ian, but it turns out that, right, Humphrey and Nixon pretty much split the vote, but 13% of the vote also went to George Wallace, who is an openly white supremacist candidate. And further, it turns out that it was the last Democrat to get more than 40% of the white vote in this country, the last Democrat to get 40%, not even 50, 40% of the white vote was John Kennedy in 1960.
Well, there's no question that Donald Trump has inherited the George Wallace constituency and built upon it. And when the Russians sent him back from Moscow in 2013 with his marching orders, the first thing he did was start that canard about Obama being a Kenyan and that he didn't have a birth certificate. And that, in effect, gave the George Wallace American racist permission to come out in the open and be racist again. And that's the phenomenon that's grown under Trump.
Absolutely grown. I mean, so while women have been really, in many ways, and black women and Latina women as well, in the forefront of the resistance, I mean, it's really Trump's real strategy here and the Republican strategy, because Trump is their spawn. He's not separate from them. He is of them, and he's the logical conclusion.
He owns them, and they own him.
That's right. And, you know, they love him. He's like, if he's ever been to Paris and you go to Montmartre, there's a break dancer who's really distracting your attention while someone's picking your pocket. And that's how I feel about Trump and the Republicans. So while Trump gets our attention with all his antics and his tweets, in fact, the Republicans are eviscerating rights. You know, 39 states have passed voter suppression laws. 29 states have made it illegal, or pretty much illegal, to get an abortion or have birth control. I mean,
Well, that'll get worse under Kavanaugh.
That's true.
So we only got a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to. I wanted to tie up the analogy here in terms of, obviously, history tells us that the Chicago riots backfired, and that Humphrey wasn't a bad guy, by the way. In the way that Hillary Clinton was certainly not a bad person compared to Donald Trump. Humphrey wasn't a bad guy compared to Richard Nixon, but we ended up with Nixon. The war went on a lot longer, as we all know, and a lot of more people died. So that seems to be the lesson that the resistance backfired back then.
Well, you see, you and I might differ. I don't know what you think about it, but here's the way I look at it.
Right.
You know, we were very young kids, and we were very earnest. I mean, we had been brought up to think that the U.S. was a democracy, and we were opposed to things that conflicted with the lessons we were taught, a war in Vietnam and no civil rights at home. And Humphrey might have been good, and they could have had our vote if they had embraced rather than rejected the voice of the anti-war protesters, women, of blacks in a real way. And I think that's what faces Democrats today. Do they keep looking for, trying to recapture the elusive white male, southern white male vote, or do they embrace the diversity that is this nation, that is the future of this nation, and really build on it and do what Barack Obama did, which is to excite it, bring it to the polls, and really get that victory. Taking as many I'm not giving up on the white working class or the white. It really wasn't the working class, by the way. Right. The average Trump voter makes 70,000 a year, hardly working class. But I do think the Democrats have to lean left, embrace broadly, and really say we are looking towards the future, not just the past.
Well, in terms of backfiring, though, it seems that I don't know whether there is a way to reach people inside the Trump bubble, but I myself are guilty of Trump derangement syndrome. And I think that Trump supporters love that. They love it when liberals and progressives get into a lather because they're so mad at him. And I think part of his support is the fact that his people like the fact that he's causing this kind of grief. And they think because people are upset with him, he must be doing the right thing. He must be changing the status and draining the swamp. Of course, it's all a lie. He's absolutely despicable what he's doing, and he's a complete con man. But, you can't sort of – I think his supporters at some – in their hearts, I think, feel that this is all political. This is the Democrats trying to get rid of this guy to win an election they lost. So is there a tactic around that, you think, in terms of – or should the resistance just get out and vote because they've got greater numbers than these people in Trump land?
Well, I think a few things. I mean, I think you resist, one, to try to – assert a truth, but two, to maintain your own humanity. You absolutely have to do that. I mean, the only reason I, in some ways, that I organize is to remember, one, I care about the people of the earth, but two, to remember that I am a human being. It is my responsibility to be a steward of the earth for generations to come. That said, I do think that I'm trying to, I'm more interested in mobilizing those people who actually want a just society, who actually care about the earth, not to say that other people don't, but if I had to make a choice, I'm for taking a stand, saying what I think, having a strategy, not attacking anyone, but saying what I'm for, and hoping that a lot of people who are totally conned by Trump, totally conned by Trump and his crooked friends, will actually get over the fact that that they adore this guy who has, a lot of people are benefiting, and I don't expect those people to abandon Trump. Those people who are making tons of money, and that is not most of his voters.
Right. Well, I don't have a lot of time for them, and they're certainly laughing all the way to the bank, and I thank you for joining us, Marilyn Katz.
Thank you for talking with me.
You bye too. Bye. And again, I'll be speaking with Marilyn Katz, a writer, consultant, longtime political activist. She's president of MK Communications, a partner in Democracy Partners, and founder of Chicago Women Take Action. She was the deputy head of security for the anti-war group Students for a Democratic Society during the time of the riots at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the student loan ombudsman quit today in protest to Trump's dismantling of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
You know by
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Halpern, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halpern.
Thank you, Ian.
And the top official overseeing $1.5 trillion in student loans resigned on Monday, saying that the White House's open hostility towards protecting the nation's millions of student loan borrowers is just unsupportable. And he is, you know, basically obviously blaming Mulvaney, who's taken over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But I understand Mulvaney's deputy is going to be replacing him, since he's been there moonlighting. Her main credits in terms of experience have been that she handled the response to the hurricane in Puerto Rico, and her second claim to fame is that she handled the zero tolerance policy on the southern border, separating children from their parents. So is this just another sort of case of the insulting behavior of the Trump administration, where they put people in charge of government departments who are implacably hostile to the mission of the government department?
Yes, that's exactly what's going on. You take someone like Seth Frotman, who's a serious public servant committed to protecting consumers and protecting taxpayers, and he's there, put in there under the Obama administration to do a job, and he's doing it diligently. And they bring in people in the Trump administration who have no interest in those things, who basically stand up for special interests. We had an enormous financial collapse and catastrophe and peril 10 years ago. That's why the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, was created. And people like Seth went to work there, a really serious place aimed at helping make lives better for people. And now the Trump administration is throwing that all in the garbage, basically at the behest of special interests. And it's you know, again, the person who personifies that now over there is Mick Mulvaney, and now his deputy from OMB, Kathy Kraninger, who's about to be confirmed, was confirmed by the Senate committee on a party line vote, 13-12. She's going to come in and gut the place, and it's already been being gutted. And all these student loan initiatives are being destroyed, and this was the right time for Seth Frotman to declare that and to walk away.
But Kathy Kraninger, the replacement of, or the deputy of Mick Mulvaney, is just taking over to head up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau with a view of destroying what's left of it. As I mentioned, she has a sterling resume of having handled the Trump administration's response to the hurricane in Puerto Rico and the zero tolerance policy down on the border, separating parents from their children. In her confirmation hearing, apparently, Senator Sherrod Brown was quite hostile towards her and was going after her, but she used to work for him. So there's obviously a sense of betrayal there. But how could somebody work for a Sherrod Brown and then end up working for a Mick Mulvaney? Where do you find these kind of people?
Well, she's from Ohio. You know, people take a job, they get a job with someone they can get a job with. Some people develop, you know, change their mind about things. Other people just fall into the world of you can make a lot more money or you can rise a lot faster by being pro-corporate right-wing in Washington, because that's the dominant political trend. It's also the dominant, you know, it's the people who have money. So there are plenty of people in Washington who genuinely are Democrats. I don't know what Ms. Kraninger's actual values are, who go to work in Washington for Democrats and then parlay that experience into working to represent banks and for-profit colleges and student loan companies and oil companies and other special interests, because that's the way to pay for your house and your yacht and everything else that you might want to have down the road.
And again, I'm speaking with David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. But the ombudsman who has just quit in disgust for student loans at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. His office has returned $750 million to students who have been ripped off by their borrowers. And, of course, when you think about this particular Trump administration, the man at the top ran a scam operation called Trump University. So he's hardly setting example here. But my question would be, David, what is it amongst the Republicans? He has over 80% support, in spite of the fact that lately he's been talking like a mob boss. It's so obvious that Putin holds something over him. And as the law closes in on Trump from many directions, he's becoming more and more unhinged. But they love him. And why would they be happy about the idea that it's a good thing to rip off students, the next generation, the ones that are supposed to take over from us and fix the mess that we've made?
I mean, it's very puzzling. The Republicans are supposed to be against waste, fraud, and abuse. President Trump promised to fight for the forgotten man and woman, to fight for our veterans, to fight for the people in what he called our inner cities. Those are all the people that are students at these for-profit colleges who have the greatest number of student loan defaults and get ripped off the most by both government student loans and private high-interest student loans. So it really makes no sense other than as pure corruption of our government. The for-profit college industry getting 80 to 90% of their revenue from taxpayers, the student loan industry very much dependent on taxpayers. They have a strong interest in making sure policy molds their way and against the way of students and taxpayers. So they spend a lot of their money, which we give them, to hire lobbyists. And those lobbyists then have influence. And the Republican Party has made a decision during the George W. Bush administration to stop being tough on these industries and to basically be permanently in their pocket. And so they get donations. The donations aren't that big, but there's something from this industry. And, from related, Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo both owned for-profit colleges, big chunks of some of the worst for-profit colleges. So lots of lobbyists support the industry, give money to the Republican Party, and the Republican Party supports it. Mitt Romney was similarly tied to the for-profit college industry. Marco Rubio, too. So when they were out criticizing Trump over Trump University, the truth is they were very much tied into the same predatory, corrupt industry and doing its bidding. And frankly, a good chunk of the Democratic Party has been in the pocket of this industry. It was a struggle over 8 years to get the Obama administration to finally get tough on the industry, which they finally in their last year did, and to develop and praise and work with champions who fight against the for-profit college industry for more than 40 years. That's been Maxine Waters. Senators like Elizabeth Warren, Dick Durbin, Senator Blumenthal, and others, and Patty Murray, are now very strongly fighting against this industry, but that was a struggle. They're finally standing up for the veterans and students and taxpayers. The Republican Party is a lost cause in this, and it's just sickening.
Well, apparently Trump calls Betsy DeVos Ditzy DeVos, and she's obviously not very bright. We saw that in the confirmation hearing. She knows very little about education. But she does wear her religion on her sleeve. And I don't understand for the life of me how it's Christian to screw over kids, veterans, minority aspirants to the middle class who get saddled with a lifetime of debt and are handed a worthless diploma. How in God's name is that Christian?
Well, I'm no expert on theology, Ian, but I can tell you she came in, invested in for-profit higher education businesses herself, and she has hired in the department people who are revolving door people who've gone back and forth between the department and working for some of the worst predatory for-profit college companies like Bridgepoint, Career Education Corporation, DeVry, and we put these people in positions, and she doesn't even have the guts, and they don't even have the guts, to put these people up for confirmation. All of the higher ed jobs are being held by people in acting roles because they know if they came up for confirmation, people like Diane Auer-Jones, James Manning, Robert Itell, all former for-profit college executives and lobbyists, that they would face a grilling about their conflicts of interest. So these people are all acting, And there, I don't think Betsy DeVos, whom Omarosa said Trump called Ditsy DeVos, really knows the first thing about this stuff, other than that she's made a few very snide remarks about the students being the con artists rather than the colleges. But she's put in place people who professionally go back and forth between working at for-profit, predatory for-profit schools and doing the higher ed work in her department. Complete conflict of interest, complete corruption of our system, and it's all at the expense of low-income students, veterans, single moms, and taxpayers. I mean, a disgrace. And, you know, I work on other issues like climate change. I could tell you similar examples of things being in the back pocket of industry. But this one, you know, it literally ruins the lives of students. It ruins their financial futures. Students come out with worthless degrees and over $100,000, some of them, in debt that they'll never be able to pay back. They'll never be able to get married, own a home, have good credit, and can't even declare bankruptcy or get discharged these loans in bankruptcy because Congress fixed that as well. So one of the worst scams, and it's on the back of some of the poorest people, and the idea that the president of Trump University is the president of the United States and that this is all happening right now is just, you know, one of many disgraces, but it's one that hits hard for a lot of people.
But we're all complicit as well, aren't we? Because it's our taxpayer dollars that are subsidizing this disgusting racket. I mean, for all of their free market propaganda and all this nonsense, which the Republicans and the Chamber of Commerce see themselves as free marketeers, this is socialism, the worst kind of socialism, where these criminals have their snouts in the trough of the Treasury and they're just scooping up taxpayer dollars. And by the way, all the ads that you see on TV for these phony for-profit colleges, that's, again, our taxpayer dollars at work.
Right. And right now there's Purdue Global, which is just Kaplan University somehow disguised as Purdue University. And the trend in for-profits, Independence University is another, the Art Institutes, is to become fake nonprofits that are still run for profit but now claim to be nonprofit and get free of all the regulations and the stigma that their own bad behavior helped create. But yes, it's all coming from us. We are complicit, and that's why we have to start supporting politicians that are genuinely going to fight for things like a strong Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and a strong Department of Education that only gives money to schools that are actually helping students, not to schools that are basically bribing the Department of Education and the Republican Party with their donations. So Showtime cartoon president, the theme song is, "We elected Donald Trump." So even if you didn't vote for him, we elected him because some of us sat home and some of us didn't work hard enough and some of us didn't get our cousin, our grandmother, and all our millennial friends to get in the car and go vote. So we are complicit until we actually make a change here. And even with the Democrats, like I said, it's a struggle on these and other issues to actually stand up for people and against predatory companies. But with the Republicans, it's a total loser. We have to get rid of them or we have no chance at having a stable economy, honest institutions, fair practices for consumers and for students.
And you can add to that list these morons on the political left who, through the elections period, kept beating the drum that there's no difference between Clinton and Trump. So, I mean, they certainly have their come-to-Jesus moment now. It's no way.
I hope so. And I hope every one of them votes for whoever is running against Trump and whoever is running against, like, Duncan Hunter and every other corrupt Republican who's out there.
Right. Well, let's hope that Cornel West expiates and other prominent leftists who made that ludicrous argument back in the last cycle. Just in the last few minutes, David Halpin, you're there in Washington, D.C. You're right in the middle of the swamp. My understanding is this week is a critical week. It's the last week before Labor Day. The expectation is that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, won't do anything after Labor Day in terms of issuing a report because it's the political season. So does that mean that this is the week we're likely to see the indictments of Donald Trump Jr. and Roger Stone?
I have no idea. I think that those will come when they've developed sufficient evidence. I think those people clearly the public record shows, engaged in improper attempts to collude with the Russians that probably rise to the level of criminal violations. I also think the obstruction case is very strong, but I think Mr. Mueller is basically in a DGAF mode. He doesn't care about politics. He's going to wait and do things when the evidence shows that he should do something. And he almost seems like a gift from the heavens, at least so far, and depends what he does, but in trying to right a fundamental wrong, which is that we have a crook sitting in the White House. And I always say Richard Nixon is a president who became a crook. Donald Trump is a crook who became president. And thank heavens that Trump was idiot enough to fire James Comey so that we have this independent investigation by one of the most capable and ethical prosecutors around, Robert Mueller.
Well, but does that still mean that this convention or whatever you could call it, that you don't do political investigations during the political season, which begins on Monday? So is there anything to that? Are you saying that Mueller's not going to follow that script?
No, I think he will. I'm just saying that he's not going to rush something ahead of the 2 months. And I think he can continue to work behind the scenes during the 2 months, just so long as things don't blow up and become public. And so whatever's not ready this week, if it's not 100% ready, he can wait till after the election. And, I think that the election will give us a sense of politically what could be sustained. But I don't even think Mueller cares about that. I think he's going to write a report based on the facts. Look at what James Comey did. He kept trying to guess how he could not muck up politics, but he mucked up politics. I think you don't think about the political considerations. Like somebody said, it was stupid that Mueller's first witness was Tad Devine, who worked in the Manafort case, because he was a Democratic consultant, and that sent a message that it was a Democratic prosecution. My view is Mueller doesn't care about politics. Comey would guess about stuff like that, and he messed up. He gave us Donald Trump as president. Mueller's just going to go ahead and do, if Tad Devine is the right witness for the beginning of the trial based on the facts, he's going to put up Tad Devine. And I think he'll do the same thing. Without regard to politics, he's going to do his job, and that's the right way to get these crooks and go where the evidence leads and get the crooks out of office, the ones who are crooks. And well, I strongly suspect Donald Trump is a crook.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt. In his business, the Trump Organization's his business model is laundering Russian mob money. So,
yeah, I don't know if they're going after that. Somebody better be. I don't know if New York is getting Weisselberg to talk to them about that or not, but that's clearly a whole other area, the money laundering, heavily documented that they've done that.
Right. But just in closing, though, Roger Stone said that he thought that Donald Trump Jr. would be indicted by Mueller, and Donald Trump Jr. clearly lied to the FBI, which is a crime. Roger Stone himself looks like it's going to be his term in the barrel, too, right?
Well, they had the meeting with the Russian that came out recently down in Florida, that also they were not honest about. So, yes, Roger Stone is always predicting whose day in the barrel it's going to be. I think eventually it's going to be Roger Stone, and likely, Donald Trump Jr. is clearly, based on what I've seen, deserves to be investigated and potentially indicted, prosecuted on this stuff. So I think there will be a day of reckoning for all of these people, but I think, it's going to be a struggle against the Giuliani and all these, this propaganda machine and the 90% of Republicans who support Donald Trump. It's going to be a fight.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Halpin.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, a founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We can take a brief station break. We're back examining the report by the United Nations, which finds the government of Burma, Myanmar, guilty of genocide against the Rohingya Muslim minority. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Steinberg, a distinguished professor emeritus of Asian studies at Georgetown University and a specialist on Burma, Myanmar. He previously served as a member of the Senior Foreign Service, U.S. Agency for International Development, Department of State, and was also the director of four technical assistance in Asia and the Middle East and director for the Philippines, Thailand, and Burma affairs. His books include Turmoil in Burma, Contested Legitimacies in Myanmar and Burma, The State of Myanmar. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Steinberg.
Thank you for including me.
Well, thanks for joining us, David. And the United Nations now is saying that military leaders in Myanmar must face genocide charges for their genocidal attacks on the Rohingya. So isn't this a big shift? This is pretty significant, isn't it?
It is very significant. In fact, the Rohingya issue, I've written, has become the defining issue of Myanmar these days, where before Aung San Suu Kyi and her house arrest was the defining issue of Myanmar, at least to the outside world, to the Western world. So this is a major shift, not only with also obvious terrible repercussions for the Rohingya themselves, but for the society as a whole, because it involves the question of investment, of relations that go far beyond the Rohingya issue, and it goes into the issue of Chinese role in Myanmar and U.S. and Western roles in Myanmar as well.
But the UN report also is referring the case to the International Criminal Court, and the report says that the crimes documented against the Rohingya are, quote, shocking for the level of denial, normalcy, and impunity that is attached to them. Military necessity would never justify killing indiscriminately, gang-raping women, assaulting children, and burning entire villages. So something really terrible has happened in this country that we associate with this Nobel Prize-winning leader.
Well, that is absolutely true. Now, the question is whether that Burma, Myanmar, is not a member of the International Criminal Court. So it may go that, but that has no effect within the country itself. There are other things that can be done, of course, sanctions and various other aspects of trying to deal with the situation. It is exceedingly bad. It is... I would argue the question of genocide is a legal question, but I have argued that ethnic cleansing has been very, very clear. Actually, in September, early September 2017, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, in a testimony to the House Subcommittee on Asia, said that he refused to use the term ethnic cleansing. But then 3 weeks later, Secretary of State Tillerson did use the term. So the U.S. has had that petition. There are people who, in the human rights community, who have argued that it is, in fact, genocide. I leave that to the lawyers. But the situation is exceedingly bad, and these are the most deprived people, I would argue, in Asia.
Well, again, the idea, the irony of a Nobel Peace Prize winner being, first of all, somebody, as you mentioned, who defining the politics of the country, when she was under house arrest, and now that she's the sort of de facto leader, although the military still have a powerful presence, what explains her situation? Is she as much of a kind of Buddhist nationalist? I can't imagine what the term is for those, the Buddhist majority in Myanmar, who feel no compunctions, no conscience about murdering their Muslim neighbors.
Well, I think it's... I can't tell you what she actually feels. I've known her for many years, not that well, but since 1985. And we have talked not about the Rohingya issue itself. She understands democracy, at least in theory. She's read all the books on democracy that we all have read. And but she is in a very difficult position. She has said, and I basically quote her, that I am not a democratic icon. I am a politician. But in fact, in the international community, she has been a democratic icon. And in politician inside the country, she has not been very successful. The reasons are very clear. She's tried to walk a very fine line between and keeping some semblance of power, at the same time not antagonizing the military. What you have is a military that really controls the country. They have said they have formed a constitution in 2008, which was designed specifically to perpetuate their control over those aspects of the society they felt important. Now, they have three critical ministries under their control: the Ministry of Defense, naturally the Armed Forces, the Ministry of Minority Affairs, and the Home Ministry. And the Home Ministry is particularly important because it controls not only the police and the intelligence, but the bureaucracy from the center to the village. So Aung San Suu Kyi can control the legislature, but she can't control the implementation of policies. And she can't change the constitution because the military has enough seats designated for them to prevent that from happening. So she is stuck, but she has done a rather poor job, I would argue, of trying to deal with this issue. In September 2017, she gave a speech to the foreign diplomats in Naypyidaw, the capital. And basically, it was as if she was uninformed of what was going on in Rohingya, that she denied basically everything, and she was as if she were in a cocoon of some sort. This did not sit well with anyone. And it was a disaster, I think, in terms of relations with the outside world. And since then, her position has deteriorated very clearly.
And again, I'm speaking with David Steinberg, a distinguished professor emeritus of Asian Studies at Georgetown University and a specialist on Burma, Myanmar. He previously served as a member of the Senior Foreign Service, U.S. Agency for International Development, and the Department of State, and also as the Director for Technical Assistance in Asia and the Middle East and Director for the Philippines, Thailand, and Burma Affairs. His books include Turmoil in Burma, Contested Legitimacies in Myanmar, and Burma, the State of Myanmar. So, David Steinberg, the Rohingya have been largely run out of the country, haven't they? At least 700,000 Rohingya are next door in Bangladesh, where they're not particularly welcome. They're in incredibly marginal land, in vast refugees, impromptu kind of settlements that are subject to flooding when the monsoons hit, and even elephants apparently trample through there regularly. It's a horrible, horrible situation, is it?
That is true. It is a horrible situation. And the Bangladeshis don't want them.
Right.
And the Burmese, the Burmans, the Burman majority don't want them either. Now, who are these people? And there's a kind of myth that's been built up. They say, well, we've been here forever, and therefore we should be citizens of the country. The Burman majority, who are 88% Buddhists, say, no, 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 you're Bengalis, you should go back to Bangladesh, where you came from. Well, both are partly right. There have been Muslims in that area since the 16th century, but for a small number. Then when the British controlled Burma, they governed Burma as a province of India till 1937. So there was clear migration back and forth that was free. So Indians did come to Burma. Then in the Second World War, that area was fought over, and the Rakhine Buddhists, they opted to go with the Japanese, while the Muslims went with the British. Then you got the Bangladesh War of Independence, 1971 or so, and then migration moved back and forth across that border. So it is exceedingly complex. There have been people there for many, many generations, but there are also relatively recent in people coming in. And that's why the Burmese government will not use the term Rohingya, because if they use the term, they're saying, you are an ethnic group, and as an indigenous ethnic group, we can give you citizenship. So they deny this and say, you're not an indigenous ethnic group. The citizenship law doesn't apply to you, and you are foreigners and go away.
Well, the UN report, of course, accuses the army of Myanmar, of genocide, and and they are very much in power. And even though Aung San Suu Kyi is the figurehead, as we discussed, we're not quite sure about how much influence she has over events. My understanding is this incredibly corrupt military junta, they've been around for a long time. They've really taken care of themselves and their families in an ostentatious and rather disgraceful way. But they're also, are they not, in effect, geopolitically protected by the Chinese?
Well, the Chinese will not criticize the Myanmar government and the military about the Rohingya issue. The Chinese are concerned about the minorities on their borders, where there is fighting going on, but it's of a different scale. It's not that enormous outflow of people that you have on the Rohingya. I mean, one of the Chinese policy characteristics, I would argue, is we want a peaceful border, we want no refugees, we want Chinese business, both public and private, and we don't want any Americans on the border. That's the China, and that applies to North Korea, by the way, at the same time. With the Rohingya, it's a very different matter. Let's say it's over 700,000, whatever the figure is, of Rohingya who fled into Bangladesh. A couple hundred thousand fled around 1978, and another couple hundred thousand fled about 1991 and 2, although most of those were returned to Burma under the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. So this is not a new problem. And the Burmese government, the military, say, well, there was a raid on us by armed militants, and this is a terrorist thing, and we had to put it down. Well, the way they put it down, of course, was horrible and far in excess of anything that could be justified under any sort of conditions. So this is going, as I say, going to affect the country as a whole and even the international relations of the country as well.
And, of course, two Reuters journalists who documented what the UN is now calling genocide against the Rohingya in Rakhine province in Burma, Myanmar, they're still in jail. The verdict was in their case supposed to be delivered today, but it's been postponed until September the 3rd. When you
that's a travesty of justice.
Of course it is, yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
The Burmese government under President Thein Sein, starting in 2011, did liberalize the media to a degree. But a lot of the old laws, even from the colonial period, are still on the books, and there has been repression. Not as bad as under the junta from 1988 to 2011, but still bad enough to make it to cause these kinds of problems.
But when you say, in terms of the general's relationship with China, the Chinese also have their Muslim problem with the Uyghurs, and there's a great deal of censorship about what's going on there. But there are some reports that indicate that the Chinese are being pretty brutal in cracking down on the Uyghurs that may be aspiring towards some kind of independence or autonomy. So there's
yes, exactly. And that is, I mean, the Chinese view any sort of Muslim problem in other countries as possibly affecting their own Muslim problem, which is, of course, far bigger and covers far more territory than anything in Myanmar. So, yes, they are concerned, and they do not want to see any alleviation of the Muslim situation there that would allow the Rohingya to become, let's say, more autonomous in some sort of federal system under the state of Myanmar.
Well, just in the last few minutes, David Steinberg, what does this mean? Obviously, it's a diplomatic blow to Aung San Suu Kyi, and the military junta there have been targeted by the UN and directly accused of genocide. The US has sort of lost its leverage there, I think, pretty much altogether, has it not?
It has. The first thing, there will be sanctions introduced, more sanctions introduced, I assume, But the first question we have to ask is, realistically, what will it take to get rid of sanctions? For example, we have sanctions against Russia because of the Crimea. Do we really expect Russia to give up the Crimea, its Black Sea naval base, and strategically critical to them? I doubt it. If we say to the Rohingya issue, they must be citizens, otherwise the sanctions are in place, I don't think we'll see the alleviation of that problem at all. So we have to have some realistic assessment of what it will take to get rid of the things we're going to impose. And we normally don't ask that question. But it's the first question we should ask.
Well, I think you can make the case that sanctions are just a palliative to make us feel good and mostly a sop to the domestic audience that the government's actually doing something about something that we've been outraged by.
I think you're absolutely right.
So
that is true.
You know, Putin's behavior demands some kind of response, and certainly the generals in Myanmar, their behavior demands a certain response. But just in closing, what would you suggest?
That is, again, what can one do?
Mm-hmm.
One can say, okay, we are not going to send you any arms, we're not going to sell you any arms. Fine. That's the easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the real issue of how to deal with the military is something we have not really addressed. As I said, they designed a system to keep themselves in power. They were willing to make fringe benefits outside of their elements of control because it really didn't affect their central core of power. Now we have a situation where we have to deal with that kind of dilemma. Yes, you can pick five or six of the senior generals and those in the regional command and sanction them specifically. But remember that Min Aung Hlaing, who's commander-in-chief of the army, is likely to be a candidate for president in the 2020 elections. Even if he doesn't run for it, he could still be elected through a various indirect means. Aung San Suu Kyi, if she's well enough, is also likely to be a candidate for the presidency at 2020. So you've got a very, very difficult and explosive situation there that we have to watch with a great deal of sensitivity. And we really don't have that sensitivity. And as you said, we don't have that leverage either.
Well, David Steinberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I'm sorry to complicate your life.
No, not at all. I mean, you and I are doing well compared to the Rohingya, so we got to keep our eye on the ball. I thank you again. And again, I've been speaking with David Steinberg, a distinguished professor emeritus of Asian Studies at Georgetown University and a specialist on Burma-Myanmar. He previously served as a member of the Senior Foreign Service, U.S. Agency of International Development, and the Department of State, and was also a director for technical assistance in Asia and the Middle East and director for the Philippines, Thailand, and Burma Affairs. And his books include Turmoil in Burma, Contested Legitimacies in Myanmar, and Burma, the State of Myanmar. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.